All right, guys, I'm giving you a big favor right now. All right, you're going to thank me later. Maybe you'll thank me if I can get this all situated here. All right, but it's coming. February 14th is coming at the end of this week. That calendar is wrong, guys. It's on Friday this week. It's not on Saturday. But this is an early warning for all of you. And also, you're very welcome. I'm reminding you this. And so I have a question, and I'm probably going to get in trouble for this, but hopefully, because this is the introduction, all of you are going to forget that I said this, okay? But guys, Valentine's Day is coming up. And I know, ladies, you can do something special for your man too, all right? It's not just one way. But guys, what is your motivation for getting your sweetheart a gift, okay? What is your motivation? I'm going to give you a couple options. Is it your affection for her? Or could it be your fear of her? guys, don't respond. About half the guys have broken ribs now. You're not supposed to laugh at that. All right, maybe a little awkward, maybe a little bit of both. Okay, well, unrelated to Valentine's Day, the reason why I bring this up is because Valentine's Day is the day we think about love. And because of the message today, I was wondering what motivates us. I think love can motivate us, but one of the most powerful motivators, I think, for us, in fact, I Googled this, and what do you think one of the most powerful motivators in life is for us? Fear. If you're afraid of something, you're more likely to do it than doing something because you love something, all right? They're not opposites. In fact, quite the opposite, because love is not an emotion. Love truly starts as a decision. And it's hard to decide to show love to someone when other emotions are trying to control us, all right? Well, let me get off this slide. Let's kind of leave Valentine's Day. This is not about a Valentine's Day sermon at all. But I want you to think about something as we begin this message. Generally speaking, just be honest with yourself if you can. What controls you? Think about that. What motivates you, especially in your decision making? What is the primary motivation? Is it your emotions? Do you make decisions based on how you feel? Do you make decisions based on your fears? I think most people, especially in the world today, make decisions based on their fears, all right? So there's what is. How about what should it be? What does the Bible teach us about what should be the motivation behind our decisions or what controls us? I mean, isn't it our faith? Isn't our faith what should control us? You know, if we let our emotions control us, there's the chance that we will be joyless, that we will go through life not experiencing the joy that God wants to fill us with. That's why it's so important for us to learn how to have self-control, so that we make decisions based on faith and experience being filled with the joy of the Holy Spirit. Satan would love to fill all of humanity with powerful emotions and fear, because then he would get the world to live in chaos. Guess what? Are we seeing that right now? I think we are to some extent. Well, thankfully, the Bible teaches us a better way to make choices and decisions. Well, today is a unique day for us. Today, what the sermon is going to be on is a next passage of Scripture in the book of Philippians. You can turn there if you would like at this time. But at the very end of this message, like I mentioned, we are going to tie this passage into an opportunity that we have as a church. But for now, we are in the book of Philippians, and our current passage is dealing with Paul being in prison. And so he's in prison. A lot of emotion, a lot of fear would go with being in prison. And so, you know, you ask the question, do you think that Paul was afraid while he was in prison? I mean, you suspect that he probably was to some extent. I mean, who wouldn't be? He doesn't know if he's going to be released. He doesn't know if he's going to be executed. But Paul had to make sure that his mind was not controlled by his emotions, but rather the things that he knew were true. That's what our passage is about today. Just before I get there, I can't help but thinking, one of my favorite parables by far in the Bible, just because it's so general and can be applied to so many things, is the parable of the three stewards. Okay, this is, I think, Matthew chapter 25. I bring this up all the time because it seems to fit a lot of different situations. But for those of you who are familiar with the parable of the three stewards, it says something like this. There was a man who was going on his journey, and he entrusted his property to his faithful stewards. And all of them acted. The first two acted based on truth. They knew their master was going to return someday. And so they went at once and put their master's resources to good use. They acted based on truth. The third steward, who was the faithless, wicked, lazy steward, what did he act on? Fear. In fact, he says that when the master came back, he says, I was afraid. And so what did he do? He did nothing. Fear in our life, if we let it control us, can be debilitating. That's why you and I, and the Bible teaches us, we need to make decisions based on what we know is true, as opposed to emotions and fear. Well, let's read our passage for today. This is what we looked at last week. Let's kind of get some context here. So let's read Philippians chapter 1, beginning in verse 12. Paul says to them, he says, I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel, speaking of his imprisonment, so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. And so this is the passage we looked at last week. Joy was filled with joy in spite of his circumstances. He learned to think of his circumstances from God's perspective. And so Paul looked at his imprisonment and he realized, you know what? I know I'm in prison, but now I know from God's perspective, the reason why I'm in prison is so that I can share the message of God's grace with the most powerful and influential leaders in the entire Roman Empire, these imperial guard, these soldiers. And so he's like, I know why I'm here now. And he was able to be filled with joy because he knew he was sharing the message with the leaders of the nation of Rome. He was also filled with joy, even though people were trying to make his life miserable. And he's thinking, they want me to stay in prison. Maybe they don't want me to get me out. They're spreading lies and rumors about me. But he's realizing, if they're preaching Christ, that's all that really matters. Because the more people who know about Jesus Christ, hopefully can know the truth and make a decision. And so now he focuses on, in our next passage, two more reasons why he won't let anyone rob joy from himself. All right, verse 19. Philippians 1:19, it says, for I know that through your prayers and the help of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, this will turn out for my deliverance. As it is my eager expectation and hope that I will not be at all ashamed, but that with full courage, now as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I am to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me. Yet what shall I choose? I cannot tell. I am hard-pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is by far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith, so that in me you may have ample cause to glory in Christ because of my coming to you again. So here we see Paul. He's always looking forward. He's always looking beyond his circumstances. He's looking forward to something that he knows is true. Now, you read this and you can't help but kind of wonder, do you think Paul was an optimist? You kind of read his scriptures and you think maybe he's very much an optimist, or maybe he was a realist. Okay, what are you? Are you an optimist? Are you a pessimist? Some people who are optimistic, they think that everything in life is going to work out absolutely perfectly every time. And those people can actually be fun to be around some of the time. The other end of the spectrum are the pessimists who think that everything is only going to get worse. And we don't have to point those people out. We already know who the pessimists are. But Paul seems a little optimistic. You read this passage, he seems optimistic. But the closer we look, I think that we can see that his mind is focused on what he knows is true, as opposed to what he's just wishing is going to happen in the situation. So let's look more closely at this passage. So Paul here teaches us to always look forward, and that helps us to be filled with joy. Let's read our main verses for today again, 19 through 21. He says about his circumstance, he says, "For I know that through your prayers and the help of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, this will turn out for my deliverance. As it is my eager expectation and hope that I will not be at all ashamed, but that with full courage, now as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain." And so at first reading, when we look at this passage, it appears as if Paul is saying that he's absolutely confident that he is going to be released from prison. Okay? Is that what he's really saying here? Maybe it is, maybe not. Now the word for deliverance there in verse 19 is the Greek word soteria. Now, for those of you who are at all familiar with Greek, there is an entire body of theology, biblical theology, where you can read from Genesis to Revelation a study of soteriology, which is salvation. All right? So soteriology is salvation. So when he says to my deliverance, he's talking about his salvation, which is the same thing. Deliverance is salvation. Paul might be in this passage referring to something bigger than just his imprisonment. He might be saying that someday he knows that he will be delivered or saved from the consequences of his sin, and that someday he's going to stand before Jesus Christ unashamed. Why is he going to be unashamed? Because Christ paid for all of his sins. And he says both Jesus and the prayers of the saints are helping him focus on that. Okay? Now, is that exactly what he's saying? I don't know, but this might be one of the better ways for us to understand what Paul is saying, especially in light of what he says at the end of verse 20. So if you take out a little bit of section in there and you kind of put these two thoughts together, Paul says this: "This will turn out for my deliverance, whether my deliverance comes by life or whether my deliverance comes and ends in death." But what we need to understand where Paul's mindset is this: Paul realizes the situation that he's in right now, it's temporary. It's not going to last forever. Something is going to happen and it will lead to his deliverance, whether that's in this life or whether that's in death. But it's temporary. This is where his mind is at. He is thinking forward based on his faith and what he knows is true. And by him thinking forward to what his ultimate hope is, which is being with Christ, it allows him to overcome his situation and to be filled with joy. Have you ever had to do something like this? And what I mean is, have you ever had to focus on part of your faith in order to get through a situation that you were living in? Absolutely, right? I mean, we have to do that all the time. Or how about this, to be even more specific? Have you ever had to focus on part of your faith so that you were not controlled by the emotions that your current situation was taking you captive to? You have to focus on what is true and not your emotions, not your fear. You have to focus on what is true. And we see Paul doing this. He knows ultimately this is going to lead to his deliverance because of what Jesus Christ has done with him. And that filled him with joy. When you think forward past your circumstances, that's what Paul tells us and shows us how to do. What I want to do today is, there's so much more here. We're going to continue to look at Philippians for weeks and weeks and weeks to come. But I want to kind of push pause on this passage right now. And I want us to look at another couple examples of people in the Bible who did this as well. All right? So I want you to think big picture here. Is there one person in the Bible, maybe, that stands out among all the other people who went through such a horrible period of time in their life that they had every right to not be filled with joy and to just curse God and die? Well, I'm using a phrase that kind of gives that away. And if you're looking in your sermon notes, you see that we're going to go to Job. So there's the answer, all right? Job is one example of this. You can open your Bibles to Job chapter 19. I'll also have this up on the board. Kind of as a side note here, Steve McFadden is going to be teaching his next Sunday school class, which begins in March, on Job. Is that correct? I'm not going to steal one of his. He's going to go through the book of Job. Job's a big book, so if you're going to go to Steve's class, I can't remember who else is teaching. Sorry. Adam Skelly is teaching. He's going to have a good class. Don't know what it's about. It's not Job. But if you want to, you can read the book of Job, kind of in preparation of this. But for those of you who are familiar with the story, Job lost pretty much everything. And he wrestled with it. And he wrestled with it with his friends. And in one of the most inspired and important portions of this story, we read where Job's mind was at, right in the middle of the most difficult circumstance that any human being has ever been in. So Job chapter 19, this is kind of leading up to it. Job 19, 14. He starts off, or he's not starting off, this is the middle of the chapter. He says, "My relatives have failed me. My close friends have forgotten me. The guests in my house and my maidservants count me as a stranger. I have become a foreigner in their eyes. I call to my servant, but he gives me no answer." Must be his kids, right? Or the ones that are still living. "I must plead with him with my mouth for mercy. My breath is strange to my wife, and I am a stench to the children of my own mother. Even young children despise me. When I rise, they talk against me. All my intimate friends abhor me, and those whom I loved have turned against me. My bones stick to my skin, into my flesh, and I have escaped by the skin of my teeth. Have mercy on me. Have mercy on me, O you, my friends. For the hand of God has touched me. Why do you, like God, pursue me? Why are you not satisfied with my flesh?" And so he is going through the most horrible time. This is horrible what he's going through and experiencing. Everyone is against him. And then he says this. Listen. This is where his mind was at in that circumstance. Verse 23. "Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book." Guess what? They are. "Oh, that with an iron pen and lead they were engraved in the rock forever." Why? Because what he's about to say is absolutely profound. Verse 25. "For I know my Redeemer lives. And at the last, he will stand on the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. My heart faints within me." And you read this, and you can't help but say, wow. You know, we don't know a lot about who Job is and when this book was written. It's considered one of maybe the first books that were written. And if that's true, virtually no prophecies had been written down. And so the insight that Job has into the promises of God, into his own personal resurrection, and the fact that there would be a Redeemer someday standing on the earth and Job will see him with his own eyes is remarkable. And that's what he's thinking about at that moment. That's what's getting him through the circumstance that he's in. He's thinking forward to the promises of God. That's the only way you can be filled with joy during difficult circumstances. This is what he's focused on. He knows that what he's going through, it's temporary. There is a permanent future waiting for him with his Redeemer. Well, King David says something similar. Some of you, I'm sure most of you might be familiar with the 23rd Psalm. It's a short passage of scripture. We'll read the whole thing. It says, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake." And he talks about a situation he's going through. "Even though I walk," and this might be the most important word here, "through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil, my cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever." And so King David knew that whatever he was going through at that moment, it was temporary. It was temporary. And where is his focus? His focus is on the fact that he's walking through the valley of the shadow. He's not going to be there for very long. He's going through it. He's not a permanent resident there. That God has set a table before him. God's blessings are before him. And that he will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. That's what David is thinking about. And so David and Job were controlled by their faith, not their fears. And then we fast forward, we get into the New Testament, and Hebrews chapter 11 is kind of the all-star chapter of those who had faith. We'll read a couple of verses out of there. Hebrews 11, 1 and 2, it says, "Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for." We just saw a couple examples of that. "The conviction of things not seen, for by it the people of old received their commendation." And we commend David and Job, reading about their stories. Fast forward to the book of Hebrews, talks about Abraham, Isaac, a whole bunch of different patriarchs. Verse 39 and 40 says, "And all these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something better for us, that apart from us they should not be made perfect." Made perfect, made complete, is a reference to their own resurrection, okay? That is what they were looking forward to. And then we get to Hebrews 12:1. This is where the author of Hebrews says, and this is what you are supposed to focus on because this is what they focused on. Hebrews 12:1. "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking forward to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God." Listen, Jesus lived his life in faith, looking forward to what he knew was true about himself. The Old Testament saints lived their life looking forward to what they knew was true instead of focusing on their circumstances. Paul shows us how to live looking forward. And when we do, we allow our faith to control us instead of our fears and emotions. You know, it takes a lot of faith and determination and help for us to always be looking forward, doesn't it? Because our natural tendency is to look at our circumstances. Guess what? That's why God created the local church. So that when we come together, we can remind each other, I know your circumstances are tough. I know you're going through something serious. I'm here for you. But let's look forward. Let's look forward to what our faith claims for us. That's one of the main reasons why God created the local church, so that we can be that encouragement to each other. And so I hope that we as a church, that we're doing that for each other, that we need to be committed to looking forward as a church to our hope and making sure that we are running the race. Well, right now, like I've mentioned before, what I want to do is take this example and kind of transition what this passage that we've been going on and look at a very real opportunity that we have as a church to look forward to the task that he has called us to. So right now, many of you know we've been dealing with this for about the last 6 months. We are about to take a very big step forward about being very intentional about sharing our faith with the community and that we are in as a church. And hopefully everyone is very aware of this, that we are in the process of trying to bring on another full-time pastor. So what I want to do right now is I want to share with you how we got to the place that we are and what this step forward will mean for us very practically as a ministry and even financially, because there's a financial aspect to this, obviously. So kind of a brief history of this. At our board retreat back in August, we recognized that we needed to be more intentional about getting the people in our church to be connected with each other, and then also taking advantage of opportunities to be more outreach-oriented and sharing our faith. I recognize, the staff, the board, that this is not an area of strength of ours, and we need to be intentional about doing that. It's wonderful that we have the things that we do for us, but we also have to be reaching out to other people. And so after much discussion, we realized Pastor Mike moved out of the youth position into a job as family life pastor, that job could be and should be a full-time position. But with Mike's full-time job, that's obviously was not going to be ideal for him. And so we said, okay, let's look for another person, a full-time pastor to come in. And at that point, we identified Wally Dawson. He has the gifts of mercy and encouragement and teaching and evangelism. He preached here. Hopefully, he kind of picked up on the fact that he's passionate about sharing his faith with others. The board had an interview with him on Skype sometime in November, middle of November. I can't remember the date. And that went well. And so we said, okay, We want to move forward with Wally Dawson, and so we had him come out. He was here about a month ago, first Sunday in January. Right after that, the board talked about it. We said, is this the guy that we want to be our second full-time staff member? And the board voted unanimously, saying he has the gifts. We think that he would be a great fit for our church, our ministry. Let's try to pursue this. And so we extended to him an offer. He received our offer, and he made a counteroffer, which was to be expected. And he also wrote us a letter, which brings us to this moment. That's kind of why we're having this today. And so if he accepts our counteroffer, we made an offer, he countered, we're going to counter his counter. All of it's very close to the same thing. I know it gets kind of confusing, but before he accepts our counteroffer, and I know that he's excited, he's anxious to see what comes of this, he wants to make certain that we as a church understand what his role would be and be supportive of this, both from a ministry philosophical standpoint and then also a financial standpoint. If he's going to sell his house and pack up his family of seven and move here, he wants to know that the church is behind this, okay? And so that's why we are doing this. I want to talk to you about what his role will be so that we're all very clear on this. We do have the job description that we created. Copies of those are back in the foyer. If you're interested, you can grab that. But I'm going to just make it really clear and simple. We have four main values here as a church: Bible teaching and preaching. Here are the next three: discipleship, faithful service, healthy relationships. These are things we practice, and so we want this next full-time position to be focusing on discipleship, faithful service, healthy relationships. That is done inside the church and outside the church. His job will be inside ministries to focus on small groups, the welcome team, things like that, connect people together. But also a big part of this is to make sure that we are pursuing outreach events and opportunities and evangelism. So a big portion of his role here in the church will be on that. After we made the offer, he said, hey, I just want to make clear on a couple things. And so he wrote a letter. I'm going to read part of it. He started off by saying how wonderful we are and that we're the best. He really enjoyed his visit. And I think for those of you who interacted with him personally, that social dynamic was really good. But then he said, and this is why we're bringing this up right now, my understanding behind the primary desire to add this pastoral position was to employ someone to reach beyond the walls of the church building into the community. Okay. Also, or secondarily, what you're seeing up there on the board, secondary to that responsibility was to assist in the enhancement of certain ministries within the church. So there's this dual thing. And then he wrote this. However, upon listening to the comments from several different individuals in the congregation, there was a discrepancy between their perceived focus of this position and ours. The comments that we heard concerning this position were nearly exclusively concerned with oversight of small group and greeter ministries. When we mentioned potential outreach methods and ideas, there was confusion about that role in our coming to Phoenix, and the conversations were directed back to small groups and greeters. And so, you know, we as a board, as a staff, we said, this is what we want. And he's like, okay, this is what I'm gifted to do. And then when he came here, he's talking to people in the church, and they say, yeah, you'd be a pastor of small groups and worship, or the welcome team. He's like, wait, hold on. Do people really know one of the reasons why I'm coming? And so we want everyone to understand that's obviously a part of it. But if someone comes here, we are making a commitment to being more evangelistic. We are making a commitment to having outreach. And that means there will be training. There will be opportunities that are recognized and getting people together, trying to share their faith. And so that's a big part of what he would be doing. And we need to know that so that when he comes, if he comes, then this is going to be part of what his ministry is. The second concern to that is obviously financial. I think everyone here is like, how is this going to affect the budget? If we didn't think those thoughts, we would be foolish, all right? So here's the financial impact. And so we do have a budget of what the new one would be like, a sample budget out in the foyer as well. There's a lot of information on there. What I'm doing is giving you the three numbers that are probably the most important. Right now, our current budget is technically it's $24,062 needed a month for the general fund. I just dropped the 62 so that it's easier to see and understand and remember. So our current budget is right around $24,000. The new budget would be $27,400, so an additional $3,400. Now, some of you are trying to do math and think, how can a family of seven live on $3,400 a month? That's not possible. Well, we obviously made some adjustments within our current budget. Some projects are almost done. Some staff adjustments were made. So we're obviously offering him more than $3,400. He's got a family of seven. But so this is the difference, okay? And this is how the board and this is how I have been looking at this. As a side note, a quick side note, many of you know that we have been renting our church facility out to a church startup on Sunday afternoons, Reset Church. It's been going very well. We're very pleased with what has been going. Their rent, now don't get too excited when I say this, okay? But their rent is $3,500 a month. Now, some of you are saying, well, good, we're there. Let's just go for it. No, not quite. Okay, not quite. We're receiving $3,500 in rent from them. The good news is what we've been able to do with that is we've been able to fund projects without having to dip into our savings. When we moved here, people gave generously, and we still have a good savings. We haven't had to dip into that. We've been using the rent to do that. And then also $2,000 of that has been going straight towards the principal on our mortgage. So we've been being responsible and Reset's rent, kind of hard to say if you say that too fast, is not needed and used for our general fund budget. And right now, thank you all for your faithful giving. We are meeting our general fund budget of that $24,000, okay? In fact, when different projects come up, when we're looking at sponsoring camp, people rise above even our general fund budget. So we are at that point right now, which is a blessing, all right? And so the big question that we need to ask is this possible to go from our general fund of $2,400 to $27,400? And I'm going to put this thought in your mind. The question that we're asking is this. Do we as a church right now have the potential and the capacity to meet this new budget? All right? Well, how do you figure that out? Mike Thompson is the church treasurer, and so I asked him to give us some insights into where we're at. Let's look at this and see, is this even a possibility? Do we have the potential in our church? Is there the capacity? I asked Mike to give us a rundown of the number of families that we give, and so he gave us a list of how many people have given. Zero names were on that list. I've said this before. I do not know what anyone gives in this church. I do not want to know, so don't tell me, all right? There were no names on this list, but it was nice that there were over 90 not names, but numbers, either individuals or giving units. I hate to make that sound so impersonal, but you're looking at a spreadsheet, giving units, over 90. A good handful of those were just one-time gifts, but this is where we're at, okay? And I'm sharing this with you for us to have the insight into our capacity and potential to do this. 20% of the church, the top 20% of the givers, are contributing to 70% of our general fund budget. Now, you can interpret that a wide number of ways. I think this is reality in a lot of churches. You constantly hear that 20% of the people do 80% of the work, or 20% of the people are paying 80% of the budget. This is actually a nudge in the right direction, all right? If 20% of the people were giving 90% of the funds in this church, then I would have failed, the board would have failed in teaching on stewardship. Okay, that would not be right. So we're heading in the right direction, okay? But this is how we're looking at this potential. We're going to flip this number around, and I hope all of you will see what this is showing us. That also means that 70% of the church is contributing to only 30% of the budget, okay? So how are we to look at this? This shows me that our church absolutely has the potential and capacity to meet this budget. There's room for a lot of growth with our giving. And again, to find out the potential, I had Mike do some calculating and hypothesizing, okay? You know, in theory, I don't know how many of you have ever gone online and do these financial calculators. If I were to give such and such an amount every month and it was 7% interest, you know, my retirement fund will look like this, okay? We did some hypothesizing and some calculating. One thing that Mike was able to do, again, no names were given, but he recognized that among the 70%, he identified a good couple dozen families who have started and they've taken that first step of giving consistently and regularly to the church. And if you base that giving on the annual household income here in America, and whether it's below that or above that, I don't know. I don't know names. I don't know salaries. But it equals out to about a couple dozen families who are giving consistently. It's only about 1%, maybe 1.5% to 2% of the annual household income of an American. Okay? What I see in that is there's room for growth. And so he just calculated, you know, we don't preach the tithe, meaning we don't believe that God is requiring people to tithe today. It's up to us. God says to give as you have decided in your heart to give. So not looking at the 10%. Now, if everyone in our church tithed, guess what? We wouldn't be having this discussion. And I know that's not reality. So even if we went halfway, Mike just kind of did some calculations, not everyone, but if a few people, a couple of dozen of those families that are giving consistently, if they were even to go halfway to 5%, what would that do to our budget? Well, we would then far exceed the $27,400 by at least $1,000. I bring this up to show you where we're trying to make a decision based on wisdom and faith. Is there the potential in our church, the people that are in our church right now, is there the capacity for us to meet this? And as I look at this, I say, absolutely. Absolutely, there's the potential. There's the capacity. It's possible. But the question is, will we? Will we do this? Will we as a church look forward to the calling that God has placed on us, knowing that someday, you know what, he's coming back. And that we can say that we did what we could during the time that we lived so that we can hear him say, well done. You know, it's exciting to be the pastor of a church because as you stay at a church for a long time, there comes a whole bunch of these big moments. And we've had some big moments in the life of this church. Our church has been in similar situations to this before. And what I want you to do is the board is unanimous on this. The staff is unanimous on this. This is the right decision to make. But you're only hearing from one person, okay? So right now I want you to briefly hear from somebody else. So Steve McFadden, come on up. Steve McFadden's just going to share from his heart why he feels that this is the right time and the right decision for our church. No, you need a microphone.
I do? Really?
You are loud, but you can turn it on.
I will.
Don't dismiss the kids. They're already dismissed. Okay, all right, okay.
Probably is funny. I have been coming to this church a really long time. There's only a few people here that have been coming longer than my wife and I. One of those persons, is that good English? I don't know. Llewellyn, and I know Llewellyn's going to back me up on this. Llewellyn, actually, her husband actually started this church back in the 70s, 1970s, okay? Since then, we have gone through a lot of challenges. We started off, I don't know if some of you know this, a little brief history, we started off our church on the corner of 22nd Avenue in Georgia, basically Camelback and 19th Avenue down there. And for whatever reason, there were some circumstances, we decided to move. Right when we decided to move, we lost a pastor, and our church sold, and we had absolutely nowhere to go. And so we had to make a decision. What are we going to do? We ended up on a fluke, someone found Duke Askew. You guys remember him? He's since gone home to be with the Lord. He found a little building on the corner of 27th Avenue in Deer Valley. It was literally a wooden barn made out of logs. It used to be a gun store, so of course I liked it. And we moved in there, not knowing what would happen, not knowing who would come, who would stay with us, whatever. We ended up growing again. Outgrew the place. The rule of growth, when you reach 80%, people stop coming. We literally had to stand up, fold up our chairs so we had room to move. I mean, there were so many people in this little building. And where did we go? We went on Union Hills and 40th Avenue. Through those times, we hired pastors. We hired Pastor Josh. When we hired Pastor Josh, we had no idea what we were getting. We had no idea how we would afford him. But we did. 2 years ago, we moved here. We had no idea what was going to happen when we got here. We just knew we needed to move, and we did. How we were going to afford it, had no clue. We paid, what, 1.6? Is that right, Steve? $1.6 million. Who in the world would have ever thought we would buy a building worth $1.6 million? But we did. And it's been awesome. We've made a lot of decisions where it's been like, I don't know how we're going to do this. And I know you're probably thinking, how are we going to afford this? That was obviously part of the equation. But it's also, is this the right decision to do? Is this going to be good for us? And God has always said, you know what? Put your foot in the river and watch what I do, how I hold back the water, and watch what I can do. And I think this is another opportunity. We as a board have looked at ministries in our church and said we would like to do things better. We looked at ministries in our church that we don't have and said we would like to do those things. And for whatever reason, sometimes that's been difficult to do. We have decided that maybe hiring this another full-time position, hiring Wally Dawson and his wife, would help accomplish those things. How are we going to do this? I don't know. Those numbers, those are pretty cool. You did a good job on that. Yeah. But I really think this is the right move. I think it's going to be a good move, and I think it's going to be cool to watch what God does with us when we're willing to say, hey, let's step out. Don't know how it's going to happen. But we have the ability to do it. Let's do it. And I am really excited about doing this. I know Marie and I are excited about it's another chapter. It really is. Another chapter in what we do. And looking forward to seeing how what God's going to do with that decision. Looking forward to it big time.
Thank you, Steve. All right, so what we're going to do right now is the service is over, although we're going to have a closing song. We're going to close in prayer in just a second and sing. And what I'm asking all of you to do is we need some feedback. The Dawsons want to know, get some feedback from us. We've been asking for feedback, and it's been kind of silent. Usually in those situations, no news is good news, all right? If people are 100% against this, usually they say, let me tell you how crazy you are, all right? And so we're trying to read, okay, how are we supposed to read this? So we do want your feedback on this. And so what you can do is you can write down on a piece of paper anything, you can hand it to a board member, or you can come up to a board member and talk to us. You can write down, this is awesome, let's go, I'm excited for what this is going to do, I want to learn how to share my faith, I want to get out there in the community. Or you can write, this is the craziest, most stupid idea you've ever had in the entire history of the world. Not want to be anonymous if you say no. But on the sheets of paper, if you want follow-up, if you want us to say, hey, well, what did you mean by this? Obviously, there's a place for you to put your name, phone number. So I'm excited about this myself. I've been here 13 and a half years, going on 14 years. And like Steve said, this is a new chapter. And I know this was going to have a direct impact on me. And I'm excited for this, to have somebody to focus on areas of the ministry that we just cannot focus on as we are currently constructed. And so, like our message for today, like all of us realize, there comes times in our lives where we have to make decisions based on looking forward, not on fears, not emotions. What has God called us to do? And if this is what God's calling us to do, we have to take a step in faith. That's what I'm doing. That's what I'm excited about. And I hope you are as well. So let's go ahead and close in prayer. The band will come up and sing. And board members, if you can kind of distribute yourselves. If you see someone with a name tag, they're a board member. Hopefully. No, I don't think there's any rogue people with a name tag on here. But let's go ahead and close in prayer, and then we will be dismissed.